Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I have a long-awaited interview that I can't wait to start with Kat Eggleston. Kat almost doesn't need an intro on this island. After all, she's also a host on Voice of Vashon, and she's been singing here for years. But today we're going to dive a little bit more deeply into her 30-plus year career as a musician, singer, songwriter, who has an international following and has been making music personally, professionally, teaching music, performing music for so many years. And I told her right before we started that I am so interested in how one launches a career and then sustains it. Because it's one thing to have a hit, it's one thing to get out with a concert, but to really manage a creative life in today's world is no small feat. And Kat, you've done it for so many years. And already, kudos, congratulations, show over.
Thanks, Sally.
Yeah, but I want to give more than that, because I remember when I came to the island, I think it was 19 years ago, I think I heard you singing for the first time at the farmer's market. Would that have been possible, you know, mm-hmm. out in the sun? And you were singing some tunes by Archie Fisher, or ones that he sang.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
oh,
many years ago, yeah. And I adore singer-songwriter Archie Fisher from Scotland.
Oh,
and I just sat there mesmerized. I could have listened to you all afternoon. And I came away thinking, oh my gosh, we have a woman of such talent who I would just love to go out of my way to listen to on the island. And she's just on the island. And I've never lost that feeling that you have such a talent. And you've made a great contribution to the island over time as well. But, you know, I want the backstory. I want to know a little bit more. I've been looking forward to, like, what got you here, what got you started, and how you've managed that incredible career while living on the island.
I had no idea that we had Archie Fisher in common. I'm just crazy about that.
Oh, yeah. I adore Archie. I think I was at a concert in... I was going to Yale, and they had a folk music society, and I can't remember whether I saw him or Gordon Bach came and had albums by Archie Fisher, and mm-hmm. I fell so in love. First of all, the album cover for one of his old albums is to drool over. You know, it's like, I would like to meet that man in a bar, you know, except he's a lot older now. But the songs... Just,
oh, no. Yeah, I agree.
The songs just swept me away, and I understand now that he's had quite a presence in the music scene in the Isles, but hasn't been doing the recording that he once did. I don't know if that's true or not, because I was like, I want more. But
yeah, well, I think he was just back out again touring.
Really?
A little bit.
Wow.
And I'd have to check on that to be sure. I'm not sure, but I love his body of work. I love him. He's stunning.
Yeah, and you cover him. You bring the music. You do justice to his music.
Oh, good.
I don't
good.
Say that lightly, because I adore
those
songs.
Wonderful.
And I know
Thank
them
you.
Well. So, and I, so there it was. And over the years, I've also seen you. I attended the first performance of the Cyclone Line, the song that you, the theater piece that you composed with songs about the Dust Bowl and your families.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing because you were doing it all. You were creating, directing, you know, performing, doing the production, singing. It was a very moving event.
Thank you. I had tons of help, I gotta say.
Yeah. Well, one has to have help. You know, to
yeah.
That kind of,
I couldn't have done production. It without Charlotte Tinkin. In fact, it was her idea.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It was see, this actually kind of answers your original question about how do you sustain something like this. How do I sustain something like this as somebody who is pretty deeply affected by ADD and has the concentration of a gnat? is that I get help from people like Charlotte, who just, she liked the songs that I did, especially the Dust Bowl series. And she knew my dad because her mother was in this the care center here on the island when my dad was there. And so we used to kind of run across each other when we were both visiting our parents. And at one point, we were just chatting, and she asked me about my background. And I said that actually I got my degree in acting.
Yes.
Which surprised her. And it still surprises people. They just don't really expect that.
I read something in an interview you had done where you said you switched to singing and songwriting because you didn't like auditioning.
That's part of it.
I have words in print, but I thought, I understand that feeling.
I hate it. I hate auditioning. I don't know. I know a few actors who actually don't mind it or they like it. They're just, this is part of the landscape and you get kind of, you know, used to it. I never did. But part of it also was that it was easier to work for yourself as a musician. And because I was able to do that, that's how that part of my career happened.
Oh, I see.
But Charlotte heard, what do you mean you're an actor? You have a background in theater. You've done some stuff. Wouldn't these songs make a good play? I bet they would. And she said, let me talk to my playwright friend, Brian Willis. Maybe he can do it. And I ended up talking to Brian Willis, who lives in Olympia. We've worked together since then on Oscar's Journey and the backstory of our local troll. But I ended up writing that one for myself, which surprised me with Charlotte's help. And then Susan McCabe has worked on the show twice, putting together all of those slides, doing all of that tech stuff, lots of tech stuff. Truman helped a lot of people.
Yeah.
Not to mention Brian Gunter, who is... the actor who played my father from age 4 or 5 to his death, which is a lot to ask. And Mark Graham and John Brown, who both have done the other part, the sort of ghost of the Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
Walking through, playing a harmonica and, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I loved it. It was very, you know, the music was beautiful, but it had an afterglow. It stuck with you. You know, you brought a period of time to life really personally through the, and I think there's something about music that makes it alive. It's not just a talking about or even a hearing about, but it's a feeling that goes into you. And I was watching documentaries recently. I was on a Zig to learn about Dorothea Lange. And so looking at her pictures, I kept thinking about the Cyclone Line. You know,
yeah, like we use a lot of those.
Yeah.
They're Library of Congress, so they're public domain. God bless her. I mean, I love the Library of Congress anyway. And so we were able to use a lot of her photos in the slides. And the photos tell more than anything else does. I mean, you can't really visualize a mountain of dust in the air.
Right.
Until you see a photo of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and she had that gift for capturing faces and all. But I think it comes out through the music. I think these are things that you don't just know about as history. You have to feel. And, oh, my God, I wish there was more ways to help people feel for what's going on because our minds overload.
You do.
You know what I mean? Like music.
I do.
Music takes you in.
I do. We ask too much or we expect too much of our conscious minds and... forget how much activity is going on in dream space.
Mm.
And so hindbrain underneath, you know, whatever is happening there I get a lot of work done there that my conscious mind is just not aware is happening.
Right.
At all. And music, I don't know, if it's done right, which I hope we all aspire to in our lives. If it's done right, it gets under your skin, under your ribs quicker than anything else because it's just, it has to be authentic or it doesn't work.
Right, right.
So that's the hope. I don't always achieve that, but I try to get there.
Yeah.
So some of the writing just hurts a little bit or a lot.
I get it. I know that sometimes that when I'm writing, because I did a book a couple years ago, it's the part where I edit it and each time it hurts that I know it's working.
Oh. Oh, I like that. Yeah. I like that so much.
Hey, take me back. Were you born in L.A.? Or, mm-hmm. And how much of your life did you live in L.A. before you moved to Chicago?
Oh, none of. I mean, I don't remember L.A. at all. I was born in Whittier when Mom and Dad were working on. Mom was teaching and Dad was still working on the Gumby show back then.
Yes.
And then they didn't like the fact that there was no weather. Uh-huh. In Southern California. Neither one of them did. Mom was from the Midwest. Dad was, you know where Dad was from.
Yes.
From Oklahoma and had gone to California. But they both wanted someplace green. Mom especially, I think. And then they were both so happy to move up here. But I had my third birthday on Vashon.
Oh, you did? Mm-hmm. I had no idea. Because yeah. I was going to ask you what brought you to Vashon. But it was the family connection.
It was my mommy and daddy. Right?
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea.
Yeah, it was wonderful. My mom had a letter from a friend when she was still in California that said she had lived in a meadow. And Mom burst into tears and said, people can live in a meadow. I want to live in a meadow. So I grew up in a meadow.
That sounds like a song right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you go to school on Vashon?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. This is a part of you, your background I did not know. So
it's just part of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
I met my husband in Sunday school. We didn't get together until we were both 50.
Your current husband?
My current, yeah.
None
of the past ones. They were just practice.
But they're practice systems. So I know you. I'm so glad you got it right this time.
I know. Oh my! Trust me.
Yeah. Well, what took you off on Linda? What got you to Chicago?
Music brought me to Chicago. When I was, I went to the Kerrville Folk Festival. That's where the floods just happened in Texas, in West Texas.
Yeah, where is that?
Kerrville.
Kerrville.
In Kerrville, Texas. It's just between, it's kind of between San Antonio and Austin. So it's sort of like a triangle from there. It's
okay.
Sort of southwest of there. So exactly where the floods were. The floods hit that town hugely.
Huh.
But there's been a festival for songwriters there for decades. And so I went there, met a lot of people who were still friends of mine.
How old were you?
30. 30, I think.
And
I
so you
just turned 30.
Coming off the island at that point? Or
No, I was before that, just from the very beginning, right after college, I came back here, ended up living in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
and did a bunch of traveling around and things, and ended up playing music on the Bainbridge ferry boat with my first genuine attempt at being married. Who was also my music partner at the time, Steve.
Yeah.
And we played music on the boats for 6 years and played all around Seattle and got my feet wet in the business there.
I see.
And then when I went to Kerrville with a bunch of other people, some from here, six people from the Seattle area, I think, and met Andrew Calhoun, who is my favorite ex-husband now. But he lived in Chicago with his two young kids, and I went to visit them and fell in love with the kids and the city. I love Chicago. Still love Chicago. I was there for 18 years or so.
Wow. Yeah.
Traveled around all over the place and moved back here to take care of Dad.
I get it.
This is Embracing the Muse, and I'm talking today with singer-songwriter Kat Eggleston.
So when did you decide to go pro? At what stage in your career?
I was about 26.
Wow.
That was when I started working on the boats, and then we got a lot of gigs from the ferry boats.
Yeah. Was that a big step for you to want to make your living doing music?
I always wanted to make my living either at that or at acting.
Uh-huh.
Either music or theater. That was just pretty much always the choice.
Right.
Pretty much from day one, which means a lot of things. Which is a sort of deeper answer to your question. In my case, I'm a in that large group of artists who really can't imagine being happy doing a lot of any other things unless they had to. but end up doing a ton of different things in order to support myself. They all sort of music or theater related. That kind of thing just sort of happened. And also just deciding, I never was big on stuff or money anyway.
Yeah.
But deciding to live small and drive around the country in beater cars and sleep on people's couches in order to be able to do this, not have a family. I did not have the bandwidth for that, but decided early on that I wanted kids in my life, and then met Andrew and ended up helping him raise his kids. And they're still very much a part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching. And that happened that way. Choices like that were legion, because living small was a big part of my being able to sustain this. It's not true of everybody.
No, but it is, you know, when I look at how people sustain careers as artists, musicians, other creatives, you know, you got some choices, and simplifying life so that you can make your creative craft work is one of the ways to go, especially if you don't have a rich uncle or, you know, somebody who's ready to endow your path.
Oh, I've heard of those.
they happen. They happen. Well, you know, sometimes people, when I ask how they make it work, they'll make it work because they'll admit, you know, upstream, I got an inheritance, or I have a spouse or something like that. But I'm also interested in those who work, you know, and make it work by piecing together all sorts of stuff. And Vashon is a wonderland for that, because I've learned that people, you know, it's my adage, don't ever assume you know who's checking you out at the thriftway, because they may indeed
have
three other careers.
That is true. I tell people all the time, you just never know who you're going to run into on aisle four.
It's so true. It's so true.
Or what they have in their history. It's just incredible, the amount of people we have here. And most, and a lot of us who've been pretty much doing this our whole lives have had benefactors along the way, and have probably been a benefactor to somebody in one small way or another.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been people who say, oh, I'm sorry your car broke down. I got one that I'm not using.
Oh, wow.
That has happened a couple of times in my life.
Right.
Or people that will just say, you know what, I do a lot of, there's an accountant friend of mine in Chicago who also is a radio host, big music fan, great, great guy. He did my taxes for free for years at the last minute because, you know, ADD. And because I am who I am, it was always the last minute, and he'd be calling me up late at night on April 14th saying, so Kat, people like that are all over the place. It's a lot of help along the way.
Yeah, it takes a community. Wow. What was your dream when you were 30 and you're going into the music business?
When I was 30, I wanted to be a famous singer-songwriter, very much so, sort of along the lines of I had a bunch of friends who got pretty damn famous over the years, you know. I liked Dar Williams and Andrew Bird and folks like that, and they totally deserved it, and would see that happen and thinking, well, you know, I could do that. And it didn't happen for one reason or another, some of it just me being a business bozo, some of it being just a combination of different kinds of luck.
Yeah.
And then pivots that just happen along the way, ending up having much more of a focus on writing than I thought I would have had, even though that's always been part of the picture too.
Right.
Teaching and finding out that, just like my mom, I absolutely loved it. And then, of course, when the COVID pandemic hit, and I didn't like to travel as much anyway, and at that stage in my life, I just shifted over to teaching almost entirely.
Wow.
Basically what I do.
So when you were making these pivots and changing over the years, did you have to work with your mind at all, or did the pivots just take you? For example, was there a voice in you who said, I should have been famous, or I could have done this?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, and how did you manage that, and to be able to keep coming back to what you love to do and not get too distracted by the I could have, I should have, why couldn't I have?
Oh, well, I mean, part of that is paying the bills, because you just got to keep on doing that. And a lot of the forward momentum in my life has been because I had to pay the bills. And good things would happen along the way. but some of them were definitely very conscious choices. There were a few things that had a couple of really kind of high-level people who were going to cover some of my songs, who, as it turned out, didn't. And so there were a few moments like that that happened that were immensely disappointing. And so that turned into some pretty heavy depression there for a while. And it took a while to kind of think, well, you know, I'm still able to do the work that I do. I've never let go of the possibility it might still happen. Somebody might cover these things. Every once in a while, a lovely thing like that does happen. And my life is fantastic. So because I can keep doing the work that I do at 67 and I haven't lost the use of my hands like so many people have.
Right.
I had cancer and it didn't kill me.
Ah.
So many people I know just got taken out for one reason or another. Something would happen to them and they couldn't work anymore. That would be the real tragedy.
So being able to do what you love, mm-hmm. even if, you know, the world hasn't caught on in the way you would have liked, but you can still have the music, mm-hmm. the hands, the songs in you. When you were speaking, I was thinking of our great community loss last year. How did it hit you to lose Rebecca Kuzma?
Oh, I still can't really talk about it. I mean, it was the way that I personally get through losing somebody I loved and admired that much, and that we all did. And I can only speak for myself because so many of us were hit so hard. But the it's the price of really caring for somebody, right?
Yeah.
So as I age and lose people along the way for one reason or another, it just feels like the price is coming due for a lot of the genuine love that I've had for people and from people in my day. I don't like having to pay that, but I love the fact that this loss is so big because she was a larger-than-life human, and it's like pulling up a plant, right? Every different person that we lose has roots that go to different places. And we never know until they're gone just how many places they're going to affect. And so, you know, I find myself that if I walk in the door at Granny's, I really have to take a few moments and remember, because that was a big part of what she was always at Granny's. And, you know, so that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I've had losses not like that, but places where I've also been blessed to be able to create, you know, whether through words or through art, in my case, as a way to just stay sane, you know, deal with the hurt when it's big. Yeah, have you written anything for her?
No, not directly. I still think it might, although, you know, the artwork that John Kuzma has come up with has been absolutely stunningly brilliant. That has been really something to see.
He's a great artist. Did he do something in her memory, or was it just part of his?
We have a piece in our house that is kind of named after.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
That makes me tearing up here.
Yeah, it was. He gave it to us after John and I played music at her graveside and at her memorial. Rebecca's dad, Jack, has been writing beautiful songs and sent me a text with one just the other day.
Oh.
I would be shocked if Joe Panzetta and all the other musicians that she worked with, which are legion, haven't written a ton of things and been inspired along the way. You never know. I mean, Laura Marling might have even written something, a great big famous musician that she loved and got in touch with. Or Pierre Bensouzan is one of the greatest guitarists in planet. He knew her too.
Wow.
She believed in reaching out to people she whose music she cared about.
Has it changed you at all, or your view of your career, where your music is going? I mean, it sounds like you were already approaching things. You'd known loss. You know, we're all older, so mm-hmm. we don't escape that. But did that particular loss change your view of the world at all?
I don't think so. I mean, every loss and every joy. I mean, they're all expanding us somehow. Years ago, after another friend of mine had suddenly died in a traffic accident and I was having a hard time dealing with it, I ended up just deciding to go have dinner, just buy myself dinner up at the hardware store, I think. And I ended up sitting next to Michael Mead. And he asked how I was. He made that mistake. And I said, Michael, you might be exactly the person that I need to ask this of. And I said, I'm not sure what to do with this thing. And he said, well, at a time like this, you have a chance to live larger or live smaller. And that was the thing I took away from that most, was just that. He's great at the pithy little remarks that you hear, again, at Thriftway, say, or at the hardware store, and just kind of go home and think, huh, I'm going to keep that for a while. So that always is the choice, at least after a while, after the shock wears off.
Mm-hmm. What do you love about making music? Is it the singing, the songwriting, the performing? How do you, the teaching? What's the most animating? You know, what really turns you on the most?
I don't know. Out of all of that, I really don't have any idea. All of those are pretty much on an equal footing. I mean, I could tell you the things that I really don't like about it.
Okay.
Because, you know, you do what you love too. And I know that, boy, after a while, I got so tired of people saying, you know, if I'd say, God, I'm exhausted, you know, after an enormously long drive or days of trying to get a booking somewhere or trying to put a tour together, all of those things, the auditions, all of that stuff, I would feel like I can't complain about that ever. If I say I am just exhausted, people say, oh, but you do what you love. And I just have this really cranky response to that, which is, oh, so you're telling me to just shut up now, are you?
Yeah.
Because there's so much work that goes into it. But they always mean well when they say that, because the things that I do love about it are, I really can't choose between them. Mm-hmm. I do get tired of being tired, and being broke a lot was a little tiring.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's kind of a both and, because you can adore what you're doing and still say, but this is really rugged. This is not what I would choose to do. I am choosing it, but I was wondering, because a friend of mine has a daughter who's a singer-songwriter. She's had actually a global hit that was covered by a Korean pop. There's K-pop. I don't even know. Yeah,
oh,
I don't even know K-pop. But anyway,
huge.
Yeah, it was huge. But here's the rub: she doesn't make any money. And her mom was saying that the songwriting industry is really tough, because in some industries, you know, you get paid ad infinitum for, you know, a great thing that you've done, or, you know, an author should get royalties for life for a book, but she's not. She's, you know, it's a really tough world for a singer-songwriter.
It's changed a lot, too.
Yeah, I think it has. With
just
the streaming
dramatically,
services.
It's so hard. And with Spotify out there, a million views will make you, what, $10?
Right.
Views, a million.
Million songs. Yeah,
it would be much less than that, actually. But with all of the free music out there, that, you know, I've got a couple of albums up on Spotify. I left them up there because of the potential exposure, but I never put them up there myself. I don't know how they got there.
Really?
Maybe the people who put my CDs out did. I hear that they do that.
You don't have a producer or somebody who did that on the side?
Oh, no, no.
But
no. You end up,
oh, my gosh.
Doing pretty much all of the work yourself. I mean, it takes a lot of work to get to the point where a career will sustain, say, a manager or an agent, or, you know, it takes a lot to get to that point.
There's a... I know, I had Iris DeMent on the show last year, and here she is, well known. She's got, you know, history, hits and all. And she was saying, you know, Spotify doesn't even pay for my recording studio.
Oh, no.
You know, it's like...
No, Spotify is just dreadful. Yeah, I can't even remember the names of the first ones, but they just feel like they're just pirates.
Uh-huh.
They just don't do a thing. There are some, like occasionally royalties will come in for something that's, it's been a little while since that happened, but occasionally some money will come in from some of the performing rights organizations out there.
Yeah.
Get involved in those and they'll do some tracking for you. That yeah. sort of thing, but it's all piecemeal.
It's hard.
This is Embracing the Muse, and I'm talking today with singer-songwriter Kat Eggleston.
Yeah, John's son, Paul Daly, his career is starting to take off. He's just a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant songwriter, and it's fascinating talking to him because he's managing to navigate this very, very crazy-looking world. To me, it seems nuts.
Yeah.
The way the landscape of the business is these days. And he's doing a great job of it. So, you know, whether or not he becomes a household word, he'll still be able to make a living at it because he's already doing fine with that. There are ways to do that. Publishing deals can work if you get the right legal counsel, if you get the right contracts, that sort of thing.
What would you say to a student of yours or somebody you know who contacts you and they're in their 20s and they're full of light and they love the possibility of being a singer, songwriter, performer, teacher? Mm-hmm. What would you say to them?
Oh, I think it depends on the person. I mean, I have some now who very, very much want to go into music or theater, and maybe they'll do fine. But there is, as far as most of the time, there's going to be plenty of people out there telling them what they need to know, which is get some good business advice, have somebody you can count on for good business and legal advice, that kind of thing, and keep track of certain parts of the business. Well, for instance, when Paul got his first offer from a record label, he had his contract, and he ran it by a lot of the professionals that he already knew, and he knew quite a few. Martin Fevrier. He said, what do you think of this contract? You know, and you have to be able to do that because the business is definitely a part of it. So you should go into your business knowing you're going into a business and make some choices accordingly and get good advice. That's what I would tell them. Right. As a nutshell to start from.
That's wise. I mean, I guess it would say if you want to do it as a business, if you want to do it professionally, if you want to make a living, it's going to mean that you have to pay attention to all these other things in order to make it work. If you want to sing and songwrite and you don't have to make a living and you can just do it, then you have other choices. But yeah. Going professional requires many different skills, and they're not all creative, intuitive, wonderful, musical. Yeah.
When I first realized how beautiful language can be and fell in love with someone's writing, I actually got to be very good friends with that person, and he sort of became a mentor to me. He's a worse business person than I ever was, and I'm terrible at it. And he's just hopeless. If it weren't for a lot of people who love his work so passionately that they want to reach out and help him, you know, he would have been in some real trouble. I think he has been over time, one time or another, but I can't imagine a more brilliant writer than him. His name is Peter S. Beagle. He writes speculative fiction, fantasy books, okay. Last Unicorn, and things like that.
Yeah.
And he's a genius. The beauty in his writing is stunning. It's just stunning. And so one of the things I've said to him over the years many times is, you turned me into a writer, you bastard.
Aw.
He thinks it's funny.
I think it's great, but
yeah. Yay, boo.
Yay, boo. Yay, boo. Well, what's ahead for you? You're in your 60s now. You still got years of creating, performing ahead of you. What do you have any dreams?
I want to write some more plays. I'm working on a couple of scripts now. I want to return to doing more acting because I've always wanted to do, well, I got a lot of training in it and I still want to do that. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of opportunities here to do that and keep writing stuff, songs, stories.
Right.
Whatever happens to present itself at the time, because it's not always a choice. of what needs to be written. I'll just kind of knock on the door and say, you have to do this now, every once in a while.
Yeah.
This is Embracing the Muse, and I'm talking today with singer-songwriter Kat Eggleston.
So that's what I really want to do. I don't want to travel. I don't like the thought of going back out on the road and doing stuff, working again. I'd rather teach, stay home, and write.
Yeah, I can hear that. I mean, I would think it's an exhausting life, even when you're in your 30s and 40s, but if you're in your 60s mm-hmm. and 70s, and you know that time is, you know, getting shorter, to use that much energy mm-hmm. on the road would be challenging, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know people who've been in the business longer than me already and are still out there on the road doing it, and they're stunning. Mm-hmm. People like Claudia Schmidt, who's coming back here in October, and or September, actually, right in between. We're still working on a date.
Where will she play?
I think at the Havara.
Okay. And
it looks like that.
Great.
Although the high holidays happen right around then, so we're working on it. Mm-hmm. But I admire the hell out of that woman on every level, but the fact that she's still out there touring and doing all of that is just, it's daunting to me. I'd rather help her find a gig here on the island so we can visit that way.
Yeah, nice. That's great. Great. Well, we should somehow do Coming Attractions so that she gets some publicity too.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have other role models for you yourself or folks you really admire?
Well, Archie Fisher was certainly one of them.
Is he still alive?
He is still alive, yeah.
Yeah.
He's still out there. Nick Jones was always my favorite guitar player, and that world hasn't been able to play since the 80s, but he's still out there. Music completely floors me. People like that.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Gawkin. Joni Mitchell. You know, people like that. And some people that I know now and some people that I don't, or just run into over time. Some of those were out there. Have been lost along the way. John Prine was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Staines. Mm-hmm. Familiar with him. You mentioned Gordon Bach. He's another one that I loved.
He's still alive, isn't he?
He's still out there.
Yeah.
But Archie Fisher, totally.
You know, I don't know about you, but I feel like these years, I mean, the pandemic was hard enough, but we're really in crazy times right now. You know, the pandemic, you nurtured the idea that we would get through it. But right now, I don't know. And so I look for the musicians who can fill our souls back up a little bit.
I do, too. I'm sure that several names are going to occur to me as I just. Yeah. I know that a lot of the people who played traditional Irish music over the years that I listened to in Chicago and the people I got to work with in that world, unbelievable. And the wonderful singers. Oh, God. James Keelahan is another one, that Canadian songwriter. Are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not.
I'll send you some.
Yeah.
Should be.
Sweet.
There's just this long, long list of people and some people whose work I like so much that if I ever get to do a show with them, it's just, Michael Smith. He was the biggest one in that bunch.
Yeah.
Because he was, probably if I had to pick I thought he was the greatest songwriter alive at the time. And then I got to do a few shows with him and hang out with him and hang out with his wife and in the most wonderful little theater in Chicago. And we were all backstage working on the show. It was a musical arrangement of the Snow Queen from Hans Christian Andersen. We were all backstage and talking about, what is your bucket list gig? Is it like Carnegie Hall? Is it, Steppenwolf, which is right down the road? Is it this? Is it that? Is it so on? And I said, well, this, right now, working on this show, my favorite short story of all time, that was put to music by my favorite songwriter, who's in the show, in this wonderful theater, and I'm getting paid for it. This is it, pretty much.
There was something I saw on the internet, and I forgot the name, where you were talking about, it was like creating a new vehicle for community supportive musicians. Do you remember the name of, there was an...
Was that Tip the Scales?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Is that still around?
No, it kind of did what it was supposed to do. And then during the pandemic, we just didn't, it lost its momentum and it just seemed to be time. So we passed on the money that we had extra to Simon Clark and his group, who were doing these private videos and then just broadcasting them all over the place with really beautiful equipment. But Tip the Scales came about because of Carolyn Gill.
And tell us what it was.
It was a reaction to what happens in a place like Vashon, like Austin, like New York. I couldn't speak to New York. Vashon, Austin, definitely. Places where musicians can't actually work. Because there's so many who are so good, and it gets devalued over time. So it was a sort of a way of trying to change the conversation. So it wasn't house concerts. It was house concert format, but it wasn't tips. It was paying the musicians a guarantee to be sure that the concept of our work having value, actual monetary value that could be expressed that way, would actually put that concept back in there, because there's so much opportunity to volunteer your time, but there's also a lot of devaluing of what we do in the process that is just subconscious. So it was a way of trying to address that. So it was a 501c3, and we had a bank account, and people would come through and we'd say, can we do a show for you in the midweek? And can we pay you this much out of our bank account? You know, the tips would come in. If there was extra, it would get paid forward to whatever next artist we had. Or sometimes, you know, sometimes it'd be more to that person, whatever. But if nobody showed up, they'd still get their guarantee and they could count on that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I love the idea, even though it's not in existence right now. I think we need initiatives to figure out how we support creative activity. To change the model from a few stars who get megabucks and the rest of the people are waiting tables and trying to convince their neighbors that they shouldn't have to give away all of their creative work for free. You know, because that...
Yes.
That is the...
That is what happens.
That is what happens. And there will only be place for a few celebrity megastars. And yet the world needs a lot of music. And the world needs a lot of art and a lot of good words and stuff. And so how can we reframe community support?
Oh, very, very good question. And a long conversation, I think.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one. And I just think that must be in the back of mind for a lot of us. I mean, I know as an author, the good news is you can get your book out. The bad news is that you will pay to get your book out. And so you pay for the privilege of offering something to the world. You know what I mean? It's like, I think they're probably singer-songwriters who pay for the privilege of being able to record.
Oh, they do.
And we'll never see it come back, even though the work is great. You know, it's just the model isn't set up for that. So I was really excited to read that, you know, whether or not the initiative continued, it was an attempt to address something that is really important to our creative work.
You know, Carolyn Gill is a real powerhouse, and she's used to nonprofit work and profit work. So she knows how to make stuff like that happen. And she said, well, here's what we would need to do. Let's get our mission statement together. Let's talk to, you know, my friend who is a lawyer in this particular thing. Let's put him on the board. Let's ask everybody that we want who has various skills and connections to be
Fantastic.
On the board.
Yeah.
Let's get lists together of people to contact for this, 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 and this. Let's talk about fundraising. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about that.
Right.
Not the way that I was used to thinking, really. And just very nuts and bolts about, let's do this and this and this and this. It was great because there's the part of the conversation that just, the part that's insidious is the part that you don't think is necessary, where people's blind spots just end up, you don't even know how to address them or what they are. And that includes me. I mean, that includes all of us. There all out there, but there are a ton of them that exist that get in the way. They just do, because people are people.
Uh-huh. They get in the way of
say the concept of the value of what we do. Say this. So my favorite way of being asked to donate my time is if someone says, I have this organization here that is very dear to my heart. We don't have any money, and I feel like a little bit shy about asking you if you would be willing to come and play for this event, because we just don't have the money to support you, and you deserve to be paid what you're worth. That being said, though, I have to ask you because we need the support and we love what you do. That kind of thing has happened quite a bit. And then there are the people who will say, this happened once. This, the one where someone said, we would be honored to have you as be part of this evening's program. And I said, I would be honored to be part of it. And then I got sent a bill. For the event. So there was no part of that conversation. Well, the thing is, I found out later that everybody who puts on this particular event, and, you know, they all made the decision to all work full time and still pay for it. That's fair. But that's also an agreement that was just never brought up. And so I was the bad guy for saying, what the hell just happened?
Oh, I've never
heard of this.
Oh, my God. That's even worse than asking you to perform for free.
Yes.
You get to Well, yeah, I get in the writer world, it also exists. Like, we will get you out
probably
there.
Hard.
It'll be $10,000, you know. you know, I'll never make that up. That's crazy.
No, the horror stories I hear about the writer's world is worse than anything.
I think they're all kind of linked because it's a mentality.
It is.
And I don't know. I feel like the arts are going to get us through. You know,
I agree.
If we keep our hearts engaged, and like we said at the very beginning, you know, that it's music that can go right in and tell us this and let us feel the stories, not just tell us the stories. And that's part of what's going to help us. Yeah, so thank you for continuing to create. One last question, and then we'll stop. Tell me just a bit about how you write a song. Is it a long process, a short process, a bolt coming in from God, something that you struggle with for weeks? Is there any picture?
Yes. All of the above. There have been a few bolts from the blue, but most of them take a while. Well, one of my favorite things to find out after years and years and years was that there was a quote from Leonard Cohen where he said, some songs just don't take that long, only a couple of months.
Yeah. And the others take years.
I mean, this is a guy who had how many hundreds of stunningly brilliant songs
under
his belt. But, you know, it just depends. There was the song I wrote about Africa, which was not about Africa, but it was about my dad as a child wanting to go to Africa.
I remember that song. I love that song.
That didn't take very long.
Yeah.
I mean, once the concept was in there and of the kind of framework of it, which took a little bit of work, then the rest of it came fairly fast. But he was always asking me for a song about this little story he kept on telling as he got older and older and older. Where he was 10 years old or so, and they were in town, and a rodeo guy came through selling his horse for $100, and all of the cowboys just sort of stared at the horse for a long time, and then they all just drifted off because they couldn't imagine spending $100 on anything. They didn't have $5. And Dad always wanted me to write about that, and it wasn't for a very very large number of years that I figured out that the song was about the concept of worth and value. These cowboys who needed a horse for their job, they couldn't ever afford a horse that beautiful. But the beauty of that thing was deeply affecting to all of them and the little boy who happened to grow up to be my dad. So it was all about worth and value, and it had to be kind of shifted around as to how do you approach that.
Right, Right.
Whose viewpoint and how.
Is it out now? Have you sung that song?
Oh, yeah. That
was part of what we heard. Yay. Right. How does it feel when you finally wrapped a song and you know that it's come through and it may have to be edited and tuned and all that, but you know that it's there? What's that feeling like?
Oh, usually a little bit of a chill. I mean, when I think, oh, that's the idea I'm trying to get. But at the point of basically done, without fail, that's the moment when I think, okay, today I'm a writer. Of course, today's Tuesday, you know, by dinner time on Wednesday, I'll be thinking, I don't know if I'm a writer or not, you know.
What we do to ourselves. Yeah. Well, if you ever need reinforcement, I think you're a writer, and I count on you to keep writing for years and hopefully keep bringing it out on the island. You are, you know, the Japanese have their national treasures. We should have little island treasures. The artists
we've got the most wonderful ones here. I feel so stunningly lucky every single day.
Yeah, it's great. I think we do. It's one of our blessings. So thank you so much for coming. I've been looking forward to this, and I know I knew it would be great, and it has been wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you, Sally. This has been really fun. You're very good at this.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.